I'm going to talk today briefly, give you a little bit of background about who Sandvine is, what we do, what we build, how we got started with FreeBSD in the first place, what sort of things we do with FreeBSD, how we get changes from the, what things are of interest to us from the FreeBSD community, some of the changes that we've moved back into the FreeBSD tree, and changes that we plan to move back in the future. Some metrics I've collected from our own internal source tree about the costs and effort involved in keeping maintaining a source tree that's based on FreeBSD with our own local changes over time and with backports and fixes going into it. And then just some notes on, from the perspective of an appliance vendor, what sort of things would we like to see FreeBSD improve on and get better on in the future. So this is our little elevator blurb. The main points are, we're a networking equipment vendor. We build products for consumer internet service providers to provide features to them like malicious traffic mitigation, so spam or botnet mitigation, quality of service, prioritizing VoIP traffic over bulk transfers, billing infrastructure for companies that provide, say, wireless applications. We're a public company founded in 2001, and basically our claim to fame is very high bandwidth network infrastructure built on FreeBSD. So here's an image of one of our products. It looks a lot like a piece of networking gear. We've got a whole bunch of SFPs on the front for I/O, Gigi, 10 Gigi links, and then a management port and console port. So from the outside, not particularly interesting. A little view with the cover off. So these are all actually Intel CPUs. All of our infrastructure is done in software. We do have some hardware assist to be able to route traffic to the individual modules that we use internally, but all of our actual intelligence and processing is all done in software in our FreeBSD-derived OS. So there's three of them in this piece, or in this view here, underneath those massive heat sinks. And each one of the little boards here is effectively a high-end PC on a small card. Huh. And the rest of my slides don't seem to have appeared. Well, if you'll just give me a moment here, I will switch to this netbook. Well, that's quite unfortunate. It's just not. All right. That's fine. All right. Now I just need to get back to you. Okay. So here's an image inside our software test lab. This is basically just one of our racks. There's quite a few in here. And basically, we've got individual units of our own, some database servers, and remote power, serial consoles, and a whole imaging infrastructure. So we can basically in here reserve, say, 10 PCs that are going to act as traffic generators doing simulated internet traffic, connect that up through a virtual routing infrastructure to go through one of our devices for testing, and have a database on there to collect billing stats, for instance. So why did we choose FreeBSD? Basically, 2003, we were looking around for an operating system for a prototype project. This wasn't anything that the company had sort of officially committed to. It was just an investigation at the time. And we were looking around for two specific, or there are two specific technologies that led us to FreeBSD mentioned up here, KQ originally and then NetGraph. So I'm not sure if anyone's not familiar with KQ, I'll just briefly describe it. But it's basically an order one I.O. Event notification framework. So at the time, it's like Linux's EPOL, but Linux's EPOL didn't exist at the or I think it had just come into Linux at the time. It wasn't maybe stable at the time. This predates me looking at this, but we needed a framework to be able to handle thousands of or tens of thousands of sockets, and KQ was it. And then later on, we NetGraph actually is a in-kernel graph-based networking pluggable sort of system where you can say take a node. If you wanted to create a bridge or a switch, you can create a bridge node, have three interface nodes, and then connect them all up in an arbitrary way. And you can build layered stacks and things like that. In the FreeBSD 4 days when we started looking at this, it was actually a very unique technology, and it was important for what we were trying at the time. The BSD license wasn't our original reason for looking at FreeBSD, but we've come to really appreciate the flexibility it gives us in terms of, you know, making changes that we don't necessarily want to contribute back to FreeBSD, but allowing us to share other changes with other people in the community. So, personally, I first attended EuroBSDCon 2004. That was my first involvement with the broader BSD community. Got involved working with Robert Watson on some network stack parallelism issues. He was basically, what was happening in general is he would be fixing things on FreeBSD 6 either the week before or the week after. I was running into the same bugs on FreeBSD 5. I spent a lot of time either backporting his fixes, helping him debug problems that were going on, and he got tired of me basically bugging him and saying, here, I need you to backport this, I need you to backport this. So that was my path into becoming a FreeBSD committer. I hadn't worked with FreeBSD prior to my involvement with Sandvine, but we now have three committers on staff. So myself, Ryan Stone at the front here, was the same sort of story, worked at Sandvine, got involved with FreeBSD as a result, and we've since brought on Tilio, who already was in the FreeBSD community, and we got him to do some work for us. And then we've also been contracting out some specific projects to various people. So we have Bjorn working on it for us on a part-time contract for a while now. And this is actually one thing that I find very valuable about the FreeBSD community. We have this sort of pool of very qualified people that can perform specific tasks when needed. I'll get into that a little bit more later. But how do we use FreeBSD? Basically, two or three ways, I guess, really. We have largely unmodified FreeBSD, unfortunately, an old, quite old version, 6.3 at this point, on our database machines. Not much to say about it. It's an off-the-shelf server running largely an off-the-shelf operating system. SVOS is what we call our operating system derived from FreeBSD, similar to how Junos is Juniper's FreeBSD-derived operating system. And then we have a whole bunch of stuff. We're still running a whole bunch of FreeBSD 4 in our lab for various unfortunate reasons, through 8, and then a number of other lesser operating systems. So FastPath is sort of probably our biggest claim to fame in our own operating system. And effectively all it is a set of interfaces and functions that allow us to take batches of packets from the interfaces that we deal with, pass them as a group into our packet processing engines, and then pass them back out another interface on the other side. So this works really well for a bridge type or bump in the wire kind of case where packets are going through and you need to inspect them or do other things as they're flying through. It doesn't really work very well as an endpoint, but there's it's a very simple concept that we've built on top of the operating system and allows us to get the performance we need out of our application. And then to help support that, we've got some improvements to the polling infrastructure, which is effectively turning off interrupts and sitting in a loop checking to see if traffic is waiting on the interfaces. We have some improvements that are destined for the tree as soon as we can get them in that are effectively ready to go. We have some slightly less polished work to do multi-threaded polling so that multiple CPUs can handle multiple interfaces at the same time. And then we've done some other tricks in packet memory allocation. Basically, we don't call into the FreeBSD memory allocator and free the packets back there. We manage them all ourselves. In our test lab, we're using off-the-shelf commodity Intel server hardware, so Nehalem class hardware with 10 gigabit NICs, and we're not running a full TCP/IP stack. We basically have a sort of ping-pong request-response simulated traffic infrastructure. So a packet will go through a SYN, and then the other end knows, oh, I know there's an ID in there, and says I need to send back a reply. And we get 10 gigabit line rate at realistic internet packet sizes out of commodity hardware, which I think is pretty cool. So other than a lot of bug fixes and things like that we've contributed to the tree, what are some of the specific kinds of things we care about and are interested in? RAID controllers, it's unfortunate that this actually has to be up here, but and it's unfortunate that I'm currently the Adaptec maintainer for the AAC driver. But it's a driver that's important to us. We needed to make sure that it was getting care and love and involvement with Adaptec. So basically, managing the changes that are in our tree versus theirs and getting the fixes that they're bringing in into the tree. So I'm maintaining that. And then we have bug fixes in general in AAC and LSI's MFI. Colin? So the network boxes, we actually boot off. Our boot disk is actually a RAID controller. We actually have spinning disks in some of our products. And surprisingly, we actually have problems with a mirror on two disks. But we also have a database for collecting the billing stats and things like that, which is basically off-the-shelf FreeBSD, off-the-shelf hardware, Postgres, just sort of using an OS the way it's intended to be done. And then network interfaces are where our real interest lies. And we like Intel. They work well for us. So we have a lot of experience with the 1 gig equipment and 10 gig as well. And generally, we've done our sort of local changes for the fast path. Packet batching infrastructure is in there. Lots of bug fixes and testing we've done. We found some interesting bugs that no one else found because no one else was trying to push it to the limits that we were getting to. Or at least no one in the public FreeBSD world was doing that. And then we have some interesting work for multi-queue, which we're trying to get it into a form that can be committed back and used for other other applications, but it needs some more polish to make it into a an infrastructure that can be shared more generally. So reliability is something that's particularly important to us. Basically, a crash is incredibly bad if you have your customer's traffic flowing through your equipment. But if the system does crash, we need to absolutely, or if the system hangs, we need to absolutely make sure that that's detected and that it comes back up again. It can't just sit there for indefinitely. And if anything's not going right, it needs to be able to restart itself. So we've got some little changes that have come back into the tree. So things like cron, syslog, inetd, if the system in FreeBSD runs out of swap, it used to just it kills a process to because there's no more memory available, and it used to be fairly indiscriminate. We've added changes to at least protect those ones so that sort of critical services keep running. Hardware watchdogs, sort of the last stop gap if things are really going south. It'll restart the system. We also have some changes to the watchdog to generate an NMI prior to that, so that we can basically, if we get into a case where the hardware, the watchdog's only solution is I have to restart the system, we can actually get into the NMI handler and try and save a core dump there. And if that still doesn't work, then we'll go back in and reboot. David? So we have a very divergent set of changes for our hardware watchdog infrastructure right now. Attilio is working on cleaning up the changes that we have to try and get them into the tree. And so in an iterative process, those changes have been moving upstream. We still don't have the full set of support that we use locally, especially things like the NMI handler is kind of a bit of a special case. So we're looking at trying to figure out how to at least get the hooks and the infrastructure merged upstream, even if changes that support, you know, our local customized BIOS and such are not things that have general applicability. And then we've got, for specifically for locking conditions, there was some work Attilio had done originally called a deadlock resolver, which basically detects the cases in the locking infrastructure where the deadlock happens and handles that specifically, as opposed to just kind of waiting for a cascade of failures and the hardware watchdog trips over at the end, which has gone into the tree. It's on by default in head, right? I think it's on by default in head. Diagnostics, we need visibility into what the system is doing. So, you know, we care if a packet gets dropped, we need to know about it. This is one little change in stock infrastructure that didn't exist before. So we've changed it so that packet drops counted by the interface now get reported up into netstat and will be listed there as drops on input. If we have errors on disks, we have syscontrols now that report read and write errors from the disk and get exposed through our management daemon. Right now, this is unfortunately, it's not a framework. It's just some syscontrols in the one driver that we were using at the time. I'm very interested in trying to broaden that to be a general framework, and I think there's definitely some other interest in that. So hopefully we can get that coordinated in a broader way. The reboot cause is an interesting one, where we've built some infrastructure so that when the system comes back up, we can say why did it go down in the first place. So you know, if all as an end user, if you're logged into a device, your SSH session drops, and then you reconnect to it, it's not really clear what happened. So our system will tell, on boot up, it detects, you know, was it a power loss? Was it an intentional shutdown? Was it a panic, a watchdog? And so that at least we can say, you know, we lost power. There's nothing we can do about that. Some infrastructure that we wrote originally to be able to collect core files and then process them basically in a, you know, user-configured way. Either a notification can go directly to us or to the customer if the system crashes, and then for further analysis. It turns out that, unfortunately, we did a lot of work there and didn't contribute any of it back, and similar and better infrastructure has appeared in FreeBSD now, and now we're going to rationalize what's in FreeBSD against what we've done. And that's one of the lessons that we've sort of learned over time, is that whenever we have a piece of infrastructure like this, it's much better to push it upstream as early as we can or start discussing it as early as we can rather than keeping it locally as our own change set and then finding out, oh, actually there's two or three other people who had the very same interest and have all gone and done it themselves. And now it's, you know, not only do we have to redo some of the work, we actually have to do even more work to adapt what we have and rely on into what's in the tree already. So we also have some error reporting over memory errors and such. And then sensors are something that are very interesting or very important to us, as they are, I think, to just about any networking equipment vendor or any appliance vendor. So, you know, are all your fans working? Are your power supplies all powered up? Is anything overheating? So when things do go wrong, we like to be able to debug it. And our applications are heavily threaded. So we've done some improvements. G-Core, for example, didn't work with threaded applications originally. We brought some of that work in and then also ported it to use ptrace instead of procfs, which was, some of that was just sort of incidental in the work, but there's a broader desire to move away from using ProcFS in our base system. So it was good to completely get rid of it from that. The next item is something that I think is quite interesting, and we're trying to get trying to work on getting it into the tree. Is when we do our effectively our own internal build world build kernel, we build the .symbols file, the GNU separate debug info for every library and every binary, and then store it away. So if something crashes, we at least have that debug information. We can take the core. If something crashes in our lab, we can take the core file that we have, the binary that we have, and the .symbols files, and put it back together and get the debug information, rather than trying to rebuild, trying to get it to rebuild exactly the same way as we had before, which is what we actually tried to do originally. We sponsored some work on Valgrind to try and catch some of our memory errors earlier on, and we're working on trying to get the Valgrind group to take the FreeBSD patch set into their tree. They seem fairly unresponsive so far, but I think if we just keep pushing and making sure that it's in a form that's clean and ready for them to take, eventually they'll just sort of relent and say, oh yeah, this is actually a good job done here. And then the final one is just because our applications are so heavily threaded, we added thread name support into GDB. So if we've got 30 or 40 threads and you're looking at a core file and it's not clear at all where which thread is doing what in that core, our threads actually have names, and it's much easier to understand what's going on. So, excuse me. There's in our threading library, we have pthread set name np. So from user land, we can call that basically when we instantiate a thread, which gives it a name, which is stored in the kernel, and then on either a crash dumped by the kernel or from gcore, that thread name is available for debugging. And again, in the vein of debugging and crash dumps, this is something that we're working on getting contributed back right now. It's available in a projects branch in Subversion. So in a standard disk environment, if your kernel crashes, that core gets written to disk and system comes back, or written to the swap partition, system comes back up, it gets copied to a file on the file system, and you can open it in KGDB and debug it. If you have a diskless environment, like some sort of a compute cluster, or in our case, the modules that I pointed out earlier are booted disklessly. So if they crash, originally we had no way to get a core out of them. So we took some work that was originally done in FreeBSD 4 by someone at Duke University. We ported it to FreeBSD 5, and it's basically a UDP-based protocol so that when the system crashes, it dumps out packet by packet the core data over the network, and then a server on a master node can save that to disk, and it can be analyzed later on. So we ported this four times now. We ported it from FreeBSD 4 to 5. We ported it from 5 to 6. We ported it from i386 to AMD64. And then we ported it from 6 to 8. So finally, we're going to do the right thing. Atilio is refining our changes and getting them into a form that everyone can agree on. And it's actually taking us a little bit more effort than just porting it from one version to the next for this go-around, because you know there's a bit higher barrier to entry. We have to understand how it works on different architectures, and other people have different use cases that we need to make sure we meet. But the point is that if I came back and gave this talk again and we've ported to FreeBSD 9, I won't say we've ported it five times. So the next portion of my talk is some of the data we've collected about maintaining an operating system that's derived from FreeBSD. And so I reference here a talk that Warner Losch gave 2 years ago at this conference, basically presenting different models for tracking FreeBSD. So the four he presented are a stock FreeBSD, grab-and-go, stable branch tracking, and having your own branch. I'll just sort of describe them very briefly. His slides and paper go into great detail. But stock FreeBSD is effectively what we're doing on our database servers. You know, it's using an operating system the way an operating system is designed to be used. You grab an OS, you stick it on a server, there we go, done. Grab-and-go is the model I think that a lot of companies get started with initially, and it's exactly what we did in our 4.7 days. You take an OS, FreeBSD 4 or 7, you take the source, you start with that. You make a couple of changes, make a few more changes, run into some bugs, have to backport some things, and eventually you've got this giant set of work that's based on FreeBSD 4.7, and you know you're stuck. You can't really move forward because it's so much code there that you have to try and do something with, and you get stuck there for a very long time. And I'll get into that briefly. And then stable branch tracking is basically the model that we're evolving to now, so that every time we release a new minor version of our product, we want to look at whatever the latest minor version from FreeBSD is, so that if there are bug fixes that went in from 8.1 to 8.2, as long as we can validate that nothing's been broken and that bug fixes are actually, you know, things that we care about, then we can merge our changes forward to FreeBSD 8.2 instead of back merging the fixes that we run into one at a time. And then the sort of what I might call the holy grail of the whole approach is tracking your changes against FreeBSD heads. So keeping your own internal branch with all of the changes from upstream FreeBSD and your local tree on a sort of day-to-day basis, and so you always know what the state is. And I'll mention make reference to that after I go through some of the data that's in here. So for the grab-and-go model, I explained it briefly, and Warner covered two main downsides of this over time, and it's basically you get stuck on an old version, and there's very little support in the FreeBSD community for those old versions. So you know, you lose security advisories, you lose support from the security team, and have to take care of all of that yourself because, you know, I mean, if we're still using 6 and the whole the 6.1 and the whole 6 branches is EOL, it's just not going to get much care from upstream. And then bug fixes over time get harder and harder to backport because they build on top of other changes that have gone in. So those were Warner's two downsides. I have two more that I'd like to bring up. And basically one of them is, regardless of how much effort you go through to backport a change, and you know you do the heroic amount of work and you get it in there, it means that you're probably the only one in the whole community that's testing that sort of exact configuration. So in our case, you know, if it's FreeBSD 6.1 plus a network stack from a different version, plus a whole bunch of drivers that have been backported, plus major kernel features that have come from later branches, you know, if you run into a bug, is it a bug in one of those subsystems? Is it the integration of those subsystems? Is it something that someone else has seen? Is it fixed later on? You just don't really know. And the other problem is that if you're dealing with a vendor of a RAID card, for instance, and you say, we have a crash on our FreeBSD 6.3-based system, and you get them to try and reproduce it to try and help you out and figure out what the problem is, if they come back and say, well, I installed FreeBSD 6.3 and I can't reproduce it, it looks good, I mean, did they not try hard enough, or is it a problem just with the combination of software that you have yourself? So what I've done is basically looked at all of our FreeBSD 6.1 based branches at Sandvine over the lifetime of our initial port from we ported our software from FreeBSD 4 to 5, then 5 to 6, and then from 6 to 8.1, and then to 8.2. So I looked at just the 6.1 effort that we have in our revision control history. So I took all of the change sets that I extracted out of that, collected the information from diffstat, so basically all of the added, changed, and deleted lines, and then just added up as a proxy for the magnitude of that change, added up the added and changed lines, ignoring the deletions. And this is, I mean, it's kind of a fuzzy metric, but it's a proxy for the amount of effort. So I used context diff for this. I looked at unified diff at first, and So originally, I sort of thought, you know, context diffs aren't really useful for anything at all. But it turns out if you're just trying to collect metrics and mine the data, it does actually have some value. And then basically, I've graphed all of that data, and each individual marker on the graph represents one change set. It turns out the revision control system we use at work doesn't actually have the concept of change sets in the way we use it, so I had to actually go back and infer them by looking at check-in comments and picking ones that have the same message. But that's a topic for a beer and sometime. So here's a sample of the sort of data that went into my process. So you know, this is just completely made up. But you know, we'll assume two commits on the 13th that you know inserted 40 and modified 10 lines in those in one file. So the effort is 50 insertions plus modifications, and then just sum them up over time. and then it's just plotted as an x, y graph. So this is what that sample data from the previous slide would look like. So on the 13th, two commits on the same day that basically take us from 50 to 80 cumulative insertions and modifications, and then just over time, how it grows from there. So our 6-6-1 based branching strategy, we basically have one internal branch in our revision control system per product release of ours. So if we have, say, a 2.0, a 2.2, 2.3, 2.4 release, each of those will have a FreeBSD6 based branch. And each of those at some point branched off the previous one. So we have a 2.0 branch, and then it halfway through its life maybe, it branches into a 2.2 branch, but work still happens on that 2.0 branch because it's, you know, additional bug fixes, customer support, maintenance releases are still coming out on those versions of ours. And in the data here, I've got both work that we've done, so the fast path infrastructure and all of that stuff, as well as backports that we've run into a problem and brought a fix back from FreeBSD. So, what's that? Yeah, there are no numbers on here for a number of reasons, but one of which is that the magnitude the actual magnitude doesn't really matter, and I'll just sort of talk about the changes in relationship to each other. So it turns out that the portion down here in the lower left is basically the effort of us porting from FreeBSD 5 to FreeBSD 6. So this the check-in comment on this one was basically port the FreeBSD 5 based branch to FreeBSD 6. And then this was all the sort of fallout as we were running into new things. We had fixes to that sort of stuff. But this largely wasn't new development. So that basically, you know, I don't remember exactly where our release came out, but it was around this point where the branch had undergone all of our QA testing. We were happy with it. We were starting to ship products on it here. And then this branch was all backports as we ran into future issues in our QA or unfortunately at customers. And the interesting thing about this is that the magnitude of change sets over here is actually a little bit higher than actually bringing our work in. And then this was our next product branch on the same tree. So you can't really see it because they're very coincident, but right around here I think is where we branched off, and we're maintaining two parallel branches. I think we needed basically one minor change for the second generation of our product, and that went in here, and then we basically had to commit the changes into the one branch and then merge it forward to the next branch. And that went on for quite a while. And then this is sort of interesting in that the second branch actually brought in a whole bunch of changes earlier than the first branch. And what ended up happening is we ran into an issue, brought the changes in here, and the original branch was basically in maintenance mode. We weren't intending to do any sort of major changes in. But it turns out that the change that we needed here, we realized, we actually really do need to get that into maintenance, and had to go through, you know, additional QA to make sure that it didn't have any side effects. And so that one also, from here to here, that branch lived for about the same amount of time as that branch. And then I think this change here was the MP SafeCam backport that we had to do to FreeBSD 6, which we fortunately got from Scott Long at Yahoo. They had done that work because they were also stuck on an old branch, and we were running into a whole bunch of problems by having the old version of CAM. So that was a fairly significant amount of changes. And then there's this crazy branch that came out of here. This one actually has new work as well as backports. So this was actually our initial porting effort to a 64-bit version of our software. So a lot of things that we had done for i386 in local tweaks, we had to now go and re-implement all of that in AMD64. And it turns out, you know, if we had actually tried to push those upstream earlier, it wouldn't have been acceptable to just have just the i386 version. We would have actually had all that work sort of done while it was still fresh in people's minds and could be tested and understood in at the same time, rather than sort of trying to fault all that knowledge back in and re-understand it. Yes?
I have a question about that 64-bit. Mm-hmm. On field deployed equipment.
Yeah. So that would be a fault in our installer. It absolutely should never switch back and forth between 32 and 64-bit. I think early versions of our installer might have had an issue where they did that. We actually had to do quite a lot of effort to be able to have a hands-off upgrade from 32 to 64-bit FreeBSD. There's a wiki how-to that sort of described the process. It involves turning off the swap partition, creating a new file system in there to host a AMD 64 install, booting that, using that to then reinstall over top of the original root file system. So our install process actually abstracts all of that behind the scenes and generally does a fairly good job of it. But certainly, it should never switch to 64 and then back to 32. I'll certainly have a chat with you afterwards and see what feedback I need to take to make sure that we test and ensure that doesn't happen. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. Yeah, so this is basically our internal copy of the FreeBSD source tree. So it is source sys as well as source. It's kernel and userland. None of what's in here is our own internal product software. We actually cross compile all of our product software, kernel including kernel modules and userland tools from Linux now and from unfortunately Windows. Originally, we're probably the only company that has a package create.exe. This is just the kernel and userland portion of our software base. And this is this other yellow branch that probably you can't see too well here was just another basically it was retroactively created somewhere around here for a product that originally released over here sharing this original orange branch. So we were stuck on FreeBSD 6 for quite a while, and just over time, more and more things that were coming out in FreeBSD 8 became more and more compelling. We sort of knew we were going to have to do it eventually, and we finally just got to the point of it's been too long, we really have to do it. So it's things like better SMP scalability, new driver support we sort of had a handle on. We did. It cost us a lot of effort, but we backported a lot of changes to get drivers continuing to work on old releases. But really, the SMP scalability story really was one of our big driving factors for this. So one of the things we did is took all of the files that we have in our own internal tree that don't come from FreeBSD. So, we have a fastpath.c, say, for our fastpath code, and we put it onto a branch that is sort of it's effectively Sandvine FreeBSD head. We call it SVOS main, and it basically tracks the version of the most recent OS that we're based on. That's the way it works today. So, at first, we've just basically moved our 6.1 stuff, took all the files that were new, and put them onto this branch, and kept all of the changes on a new branch that we created. And then we ported that from FreeBSD 6 to 8.1 and then to 8.2. So the interesting thing here is that this graph started way up because all of the changes, we basically just took them out of that 6.1 branch, dropped them in this new branch, which was still 6.1 based. And so that's why it starts up here. And then we did a little bit of effort to just clean some things up and get it into a buildable state. And then from there, this basically here, this inflection point here is basically when we started porting to FreeBSD 8. So this amount of effort here is all of the work that we did to port both the files that were on that separate branch plus in stock FreeBSD to 8.1. And then 8.2 was this extra little blip up here. The reason actually that 8.2 was a fair bit of change is that we never actually completed merging all of the stuff that we had left over from FreeBSD 6 to FreeBSD 8. 8.2 really, or to 8.1. 8.2 released, and we were still in progress. So we basically said, well, we might as well just drop the 8.1 effort, move to 8.2, and we brought those changes just into here. So next I'm going to put all the data on one graph and then basically show each of the individual individual branch graphs all rebased to start from zero. So first of all, this is the FreeBSD 6 branches and the FreeBSD 8 branch on one graph. And this, you can see basically the FreeBSD, the SVUS main branch that starts here was basically, we took the work that was here and just brought it over. There's some other stuff in here that kind of, some other uninteresting branches, but this point basically is this amount of, this code base just brought over. So this is what I mean by rebasing them all from zero. So this is our first FreeBSD 6 base, 6.1 base branch, and then our next one that, so it would have originally branched off from there, but then this makes it a little bit clearer to see how the lifetime of the branches overlap and the magnitude of changes in each of them. So those are our four 6.1 base branches. And then this data is our FreeBSD 8 branches, including this SVOS main work that we basically should have to do only once with some minor changes to move it forward as we go from 8 to 9, for instance. And then the 8.1 effort and the 8.2 effort, which was cleaning up a few final things. David? That is a good question. Yeah, it probably actually should be down here. I guess I think it actually should be up there because the one thing that change was has that's different from all of these ones is this one basically started from zero changes and we merged things in. Because that change basically started that change basically started with all of those changes merged over. I mean, if anything, there should be a line from here down. Like we could add an extra point at zero and draw the line up to it. So here's the interesting data that comes out of it. So we basically had four 6.1 base branches. The second one had a slightly longer lifetime than the first one, and then about two-thirds the time for each of the subsequent ones. And over time, over the lifetime of that branch, the amount of added plus changed lines, is aside from this one, which was fairly short-lived, a fairly specific branch, we actually ended up doing about the same magnitude of effort in each of them. So in comparison to all of the work we did on FreeBSD 6.1, about half the total lines of change are what went into our main branch. What that basically means is that we sort of have this two times overhead of churn and just keeping those branches, those simultaneous branches alive and doing the same changes in multiple branches. It's not actually an awful lot of extra development effort, but it is a lot of integration and build and test and other ancillary sort of effort. And, of course, the number here is very, very low because we basically just took those changes and dropped them over. And then to go to FreeBSD 8.1, it was about 20%-ish, 18% of the added plus change lines. And the duration here is not really all that interesting necessarily because we haven't actually released a product on FreeBSD 8 yet. So, I mean, as these branches start living a little bit longer, this will go up. But the really interesting thing is that we actually brought in more changes into 8.2 that hadn't already been merged to 8.1. We skipped. And it's the cumulative changes is actually way, way lower. And that's partially we've dropped out a number of changes that we just don't need anymore. We were carrying patch sets around that didn't actually have a lot of value. But largely because we've been pushing lots and lots of our small changes and bug fixes back upstream, and we did a lot of that work in the time frame between when we started porting to 8.1 and when 8.2 released. So the changes that we pushed upstream went into head, got MFC'd to 8 after 8.1, and now that we're going to 8.2, a lot of our changes have come back in from FreeBSD, and we don't need to maintain those patches anymore. So I mentioned that, yeah, we ended up with about half the overall churn. The next point, I think, is a very interesting and key one that I discovered from all of this data, that basically It's about the same amount of duration and effort to port our local custom changes now forward from one minor release to the next, so from 8.1 to 8.2, as it is to take one non-trivial bug fix or FreeBSD feature and backport it into our old branch. So something like MPSafeCam, for instance, is what I would call a non-trivial non-trivial backport. The next point is sort of just a release engineering, internal release engineering kind of issue. As much as possible, it's much better to have the same internal FreeBSD code base shared across as many products, product releases as possible, as opposed to having all of these long-lived individual branches that are all collecting the same sets of changes. So we can bring in bug fixes by tracking FreeBSD and avoid having ever-growing backports. So the longer term, it's much, much cheaper for us to get our changes into FreeBSD and then ignore that patch set from then on than basically have to keep merging it and testing it. We basically put it into FreeBSD and, you know, sort of a set it and forget it. It goes upstream and then we don't really care about it anymore. Obviously, we still test that it's working and that it's not getting broken, but it doesn't cost us really anything to keep changing that. And then the next point is what I want to experiment with, and in talking with some other FreeBSD derived companies using FreeBSD in their derived operating system, I really want to try tracking our local change sets against FreeBSD current on an ongoing basis. And one of the big items of value I hope to get out of this is that if a change is being made in a subsystem that we interact with in upstream FreeBSD, and all of a sudden, you know, either the patch doesn't apply anymore, or our tests start telling us, oh, this is failing, it's much easier to talk to the person in the community who's working on that change at the time and say, look, we rely on this, you know, can you either keep this old API around for us or help us understand what sort of model we should be using for this, rather than saying, oh, this change that was made 3 years ago is conflicting with our local changes. We just don't know what to do. And the person who did that change has moved on and isn't interested in helping out anymore, or whatever the case might be. So any questions on that topic before I move on to my final set of points? Okay. So my last set of points is just some notes about where I'd like to see FreeBSD go, and this is my observations as both working for a company that builds a product derived from with an operating system derived from FreeBSD, and as a FreeBSD committer. And this is largely, I don't have ideas about how to solve this necessarily. This is what I'd like to see. So the first one that's a big pain point for me is our whole build packaging infrastructure. It works quite well for building the components that we release as the FreeBSD community. It doesn't really work quite well for building components that, as a derived appliance vendor, I need. In talking to other companies, it seems everyone has basically their own sets of shell scripts and tools and things that they've built on top of what's there that have all gone off in different ways. I think we're starting to see some of the parts that I'd like to be able to use coming into the tree. So our two new installers that we have available in the tree now, I think, provide some back-end components that we're going to be able to reuse for some of the things we need. But this is basically what I'd like to be able to do, is take the source tree that's FreeBSD and a ports tree, and have, you know, either VMware images, releasable ISO images, tar files, whatever, just all come out of the same sort of overall build infrastructure. And so what I'm really looking to try and end up with here is a toolkit, so different components that can be put together as companies need them. We have a number of tools. NanoBSD is the one that comes up quite often. And, you know, if NanoBSD meets your needs, it works quite well for what it is. But it's not really extensible to say, well, I want this part and this part and this part, but I don't really need that other thing. So I'm not sure that I have a lot of useful insight into the developer pain points in a way that's relevant to FreeBSD. largely because of some historical reasons that in the way that Sandvine developed. Our source control system doesn't work on FreeBSD, for one thing, which is a huge impediment to actually getting stuff done, because you can't check out your source tree on FreeBSD. So all of our applications and our kernel modules for the product side are all cross-built from Linux. Our build process for our FreeBSD components actually check out of that same source tree, SCP files over to a FreeBSD build host and build it. So, I mean, that overall is a pain point. I don't think I have as much of an informed opinion on these are the individual things that we need to fix in the base sort of for developers. My final point is we have this distinction between the base source tree and the ports tree in the FreeBSD community, and I mean it's not really a there's two separate factions or anything. It's just the two sets of software are packaged differently, are maintained differently. They're in separate repositories, and there's different processes that that both teams use. And from the point of view of an appliance vendor, it doesn't really matter to me where the software comes from. I'd really like to be able to apply some common tools and common infrastructure to stuff that comes out of the FreeBSD base tree, ports tree, our own internal source repository, some tools that we can share across all of them. Documentation. I think, in general, we have some excellent documentation in FreeBSD and BSTs in general. I changed my slides to BSTAR BSD because this is actually true. It's applicable across all of the different BSD operating systems. One thing I'd really like to see, and I was joking that I condensed Michael Lucas's talk down to one bullet point on one slide, but definitely more books. I want to be able to say, if I have a new developer who's come on, I mean, I didn't have FreeBSD experience at the time I started working at Sandvine and went into this role. Ryan didn't. I'd like to be able to say, I've got a new guy who's going to be working on this kind of thing. Buy these three books. This tells you what you need to know. And we have some good books. Some of them are starting to get outdated, applying to releases that are no longer current. But definitely up-to-date and more books. Next point came from an observation I saw while one of my coworkers had basically, in a very short amount of time, had a number of instances of Ubuntu virtual machine with some user mode Linux instances running and everything. And, I mean, he didn't really know what he was doing. He just went, found some how-to on the web, and just sort of, you know, cut and paste the commands. And this is one thing I think that we have some good examples of this, and I think we can have a lot more. It doesn't really matter how trivial something seems to be. If there's if there's something you've done that took you more than 10 or 15 minutes, write it up, make it a how-to, and stick it somewhere, a blog post, whatever it is. Someone will find it and be able to replicate your stuff. And I think in the BSD community we sort of have. There's a bit of a this opinion that things that are really easy, there's no point in documenting it. Once you figured it out, it's obvious. But try and remember when what it was like before you'd figured it out, when it wasn't obvious. Some specific developer tools. I mean, I guess maybe Marcel, this goes a little bit to your point. This is. Some of the things from a developer perspective that I'd like to see. Your earlier question about the pain points, I think the biggest pain point for me is how we would integrate these tools into our own internal developer environment. But having the tools available in general is something that I think we can get out of the FreeBSD community. The final point on here, VM images, there's been a lot of good discussion actually at this conference on this. What I'd really like to be able to see is a VM image available on www.freebsd.org, whatever. If I wanted to try FreeBSD 8.2, just download it and stick it on. My coworker did this with an Ubuntu image that he found, and it has it up and running in a couple of minutes. it's not that hard to take a ISO install image and create a virtual disk and whatever, but it's that little bit harder that if you don't actually care about if it's Linux or FreeBSD, you just want to try something, or you've heard about some great cool technology in FreeBSD like dtrace and you want to see what it's like, just having that image there to just download and try is great. So, you know, the ZFS images that PJD was creating are a good example of this. I downloaded the one he had created for the ZFS V28 backport and tried it out, and it was trivial to see, oh yeah, it does work and seems pretty cool. And then the final point is I'd really like to see the committer base grow. We have an excellent community in FreeBSD. It's at a conference like this, it's amazing how many people you can talk to who have similar problems and who are all operating at a very, very high level. What I don't have a sense of as much is sort of the broader contributor base. We don't seem to have as much of a good story for developer advocacy, bringing new people into the fold. If someone has an interest in operating systems in general, how do we get them to say, I want to try FreeBSD, I want to learn more about that? So that's one thing I think we need to try and figure out how to do. I'd really like to see more communication between different projects. I mentioned the Debian GNU/KFreeBSD project here. If anyone's seen me in the IRC channels, I bring this one up a lot. And I'm not really sure, from my perspective, what value sticking the GNU user land on top of the FreeBSD kernel really provides, but I think it's a really cool project. There's more people trying out our FreeBSD kernel, at least, seeing what it has. The reason some people are interested in it is things like, I love the GNU user land and I want to run ZFS. Hey, why not? If someone wants to do that, they're more than welcome to. And they also give us a lot of testing and try things that we otherwise maybe not wouldn't use in our system. So I think definitely anyone who isn't yet aware of that, it's definitely interesting to at least have a look at their wiki and see what some of the things they're doing doing are about. And then conferences. I mean, this is BSD Can. It's amazing the value that we get out of it. I think we need to have more opportunities for interaction between committers, between contributors, between companies using FreeBSD. I can't even really fathom how much value I get out of this conference for the small amount of money it costs, but it happens once a year. Of course, we do have EuroBSDCon, AsiaBSDCon, but how do we get more sort of smaller conferences going? I'm not sure what we really need here, but we need to have more venues for people to talk to each other. And I think that's about all I have. So if there's any questions, I'll be happy to take them. So right now we are tracking, we're merging our change sets to 8.1. So we're basically, 8.2, thanks Ryan. We're not actually tracking stable 8. We import the source tree from FreeBSD, from CVS, not from Subversion for some historical reasons. So a change goes into Subversion, then the FreeBSD's CVS mirror picks that up, we take it out of the CVS mirror and bring it into our own internal source tree. And so on a change-by-change basis, we have the latest changes coming in. Right now, our build process is such that, or our development process is such that we pick up 8.1 or 8.2 and branch off there and merge. My goal is to experiment with doing stable 8 first, and then my eventual goal is that we will be building on head, build our source on head to test.
Mostly because we do have exactly the same thing that the same has. The more you can give back, the easier it is. Mm-hmm. One of the values that we see is when you have a vested interest in FreeBSD, it helps that you can, well, not so much control the project, but be part of setting direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would even go one step further to the extent that some piece of technology that you care about is going to get implemented in the tree by someone eventually, it might as well be the way you want it to work. You know, it's much better to have something be exactly what you want in the tree and it meets other people's needs than someone else gets it into the tree and it's exactly what they wanted, and you know, you can adapt it to what you need, but it's not exactly the way it was intended. I think it absolutely is going to. So what I mentioned earlier is I would really like Sandvine to start releasing the most recent FreeBSD miner release in each of our own internal product miner releases. So I think for a release perspective, tracking stable and then branching off. So tracking stable as we go through our development process, and then as we come up to a release, follow 8.1 or 8.2 or 8.3 down that's going to release into a product is an excellent model. For internal development, I think it is absolutely going to be valuable for us and lower cost overall for us to be testing on current with our changes. And you know, I think as soon as we find the first case of some subsystem changed, and that would have cost us a huge amount of effort close to a release to try and figure out how to adapt what's happened there into our own internal base to be able to say, even if all we do is say, you know, we port it to head, we have our automated regressions running, it starts failing, the patch doesn't apply, or the regression test fails, and we say, oh, we know that this is going to be an issue, we need to schedule this in, you know, for our release 6 months out. We know that there's a month worth of work that we can put into the schedule, rather than saying, "Oh, there's a release coming up, and you know we're stuck." And the sort of corollary to that is, if you don't know what's going to be what you might run into, it forces you into this model of saying, "Well, we know that if we stay on 6.1, obviously we don't. You know, it doesn't matter what happens in FreeBSD. All the changes can happen there. It doesn't affect us because we're not moving forward." And then we get so far behind, and we say, "Oh, well, this doesn't scale to more than 2 or 4 cores," and oh, there's you know, we have to backport support to get above 96 gigabytes or above 64 gigabytes of memory into the database machines. Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So you know, if you commit a change that conflicts with something I've been working on in our tree, I can say, you know, even if you can't fix it for me, I can say, can you explain how I might be able to adapt that to what I need to do, which is this. Yeah. Ryan?
It's also worth noting that it's a total lie that you can just stay on 6.1 and everything's going to work out.
Well, and the unfortunate thing of that graph with those backport changes coming in is the reason those backports went in is because either our QA group or even worse our customers ran into a problem, and you know when the process is you have a kernel core, you look in the FreeBSD tree, you find the fix that went into head 3 years ago and was MFC'd to FreeBSD 6 2.5 years ago, it's just not a scalable, sustainable model. I guess I can answer it. I've commented on it in the FreeBSD groups IRC channels often enough. So we're actually using ClearCase, which has some interesting properties, and we use it fairly well. You know, I think had we started today on this, we wouldn't have said we're going to use FreeBSD for our product. We're going to pick a version control system that can't even run on the operating system that we're targeting. But it's what we have. Max, you had a question?
How much do you do preemptively, like monitoring, mailing list discussions, areas that interest you? Do you account time for that for your developers and stuff? Do you have people read mailing list on your development stuff in our customers?
So, My first comment is, this is an area that I hope that we will do better on as we move forward. So far, it's been somewhat of an ad hoc basis. You know, I watch the FreeBSD Subversion commit mailing list. As a developer, I have to. As a committer, I have to. Ryan is a committer now. Basically, that was my secret plan to make Ryan a committer so that he has the same obligations. You know, in an ad hoc basis, absolutely, it's happening. And my I have a co-op student who is also following the FreeBSD the FreeBSD mailing lists and bought himself an AMD 6-core machine for home to act as a FreeBSD build server because he's interested in it. So I think that it definitely happens. One of my challenges is going to be to sort of more formalize that and say, you know, yes, this is there is a huge amount of value in doing this, and it's excellent to be able to schedule it up front rather than, you know, if I can prove that spending a week getting something into a state where it can go into the tree is going to save us the effort of maintaining it, but it doesn't buy us anything right in the current time frame. If I can make that connection and get that well understood across the company, I think it's easy to make the case that, you know, people who are working in FreeBSD-derived OSs need to spend some of their time adapting local patches to upstream, following the mailing lists, testing things out in on different architectures, that sort of thing. Does that answer? So two excellent questions. On the sort of lawyer front, this wasn't by design, but we are actually quite lucky, I think, that our version control system doesn't work on FreeBSD. So all of our product code is in a completely separate repository. In a completely separate repository, completely separate tool chain, it's completely isolated. So what it means is that for the most part, that FastPath code that I was talking about is really the closest thing that we have to IP in the FreeBSD-derived tree. And originally, 5 years ago, maybe when we started doing that, we thought maybe it was a competitive advantage to have this, to be able to get traffic through through a software stack that quickly. It turns out now other people are starting to do it anyway. Stuff's going into Linux to support some of this kind of stuff, direct packet dispatch to userland. The biggest impediment to us putting stuff like that upstream is probably code cleanliness and applicability as opposed to any sort of IP issues. In general, anything that I've that's in the data that I've been talking about, Sandpine would be very, very happy to have, you know, to have it upstream. Our goal for all of this would be that our local change set goes to zero. Remind me of the second question?
When you do hit bugs, like
right, do we right. Yeah, so we haven't yet got to the point of saying we found a bug, next step, reproduce it on head, next step, get it into head, get the fix into head, next step, MFC it to FreeBSD, next step, bring it from there back into our tree. We haven't got there. Certainly when we find a bug now, you know, especially if it's a customer bug, absolutely it's got to get fixed on our own branch. What we have done in our model, though, is as soon as we found that kind of bug and need to get it fixed, we immediately try to get the same reproduction effort going on head and get the fix in. So Bjorn, we had there was some sort of a networking bug that we the races in ifconfig or something where we had a shell script that was reproduced, or we actually ran into a customer issue. We were able to reproduce it with a trivial shell script on our FreeBSD 6.1 base tree. The same shell script would reproduce the problem on head, but with a little bit, it would have to run for a little bit longer. And this was basically simultaneously bringing interfaces up and down, stuff like that. So, you know, absolutely, we had Bjorn. I don't even recall if you did that on us for contract or that was just we worked with you. But anyway, so we found the bug in head, confirmed that the bug still existed in head, and said we need to get it fixed there so that it doesn't come back to bite us in the future. Okay, thank you.